You're listening to His Time, your morning drive for the soul. Time to move from our prayer to our meditation, from oratio to meditatio. Looking more closely at the words of Psalm 80, verses 1 through 7, which we heard read just a few moments ago. There is so much cool stuff in this psalm, and if you're just reading along in English, the early part really is going to throw you off, maybe, just because it drops a couple of names, which you know these names, but when they get used in a poetic or prophetic way, they can seem kind of weird, right? Before Ephraim and Benjamin and Manasseh, stir up your might and come to save us. What's going on there, right? But we'll come to that. But it's easy to miss some of the other repetitions that show up, which give structure to the psalm and help us kind of break into it. For example, there is a chorus that happens three different times, and every time that it happens, it actually builds. And so you really have a prayer being prayed sort of three times, but amplifying itself and leading toward a final conclusion. So verse 3 that says, "Restore us, O God, let your face shine that we may be saved," is followed up by verse 7, "Restore us, O God of hosts, let your face shine that we may be saved." And it's important, you don't get this in the English, sadly, but this was, "Restore us, O Elohim," very classic Old Testament word for God. But then it's, "Restore us, O Elohim Sabaoth," right? And you recognize this from the old TLH liturgies, right? "Lord God of Sabaoth." As a kid, I used to think that meant Lord God of Sabbath, God of Sunday. But no. Sabaoth, it literally means armies or warfare. I like to translate it in my own head, at least, as God of war. Not because God is into war, just because. But when he goes out against evil, he doesn't go out meekly. Jesus, in his meekness, was a warrior, piercing the head of that serpent for us, as prophesied of old, right? So, restore us, O God, restore us, O God, Sabaoth. And then finally, the closing verse, verse 19, "Restore us, O Yahweh, Elohim, Sabaoth," right? Now you're bringing in the proper name of God, calling him the Lord, it gets translated, but it's his proper name, Yahweh, one who is the God of war. Now, why would they be praying such a thing? And this is where these names from earlier, Ephraim, Benjamin, and Manasseh, give us a hint as to what's going on around this. Now, there's some debate among scholars about whether this is before or after the final destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel. I know we've talked about this before, but it's always good to review really quick. After David and after Solomon, there came Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and he rifted the kingdom in half. And from that point on, there were two kingdoms, the north and the south. They were always vying for power over each other. In the south, they kind of remained faithful. In the north, they became pagans very, very quickly. The north was called Israel. The south was called Judah, even though part of Benjamin was in Judah, but not all of it, right? Not all of it. It was mostly Judah, and then you got some Levites down there. And eventually God utterly destroys the north, Israel, wipes them off the map with a country named Assyria. Assyria actually then loses its own power as part of a punishment for daring to attack God's people. Funny how that works. And then Judah eventually also is destroyed by Babylon, but they're not wiped off the map. Whereas Assyria had taken those 10 tribes of the north and dispersed them to the edges of the world and intermingled and forced them to intermarry, basically slave trade, with all sorts of other pagan groups. So they became the lost tribes of Israel. Judah is kept alone, secure, but in exile in Babylon, but then they're restored. They come back and they are planted again in the land. Now, this is definitely not a prayer about the restoration of Judah. We know that for sure. Because of these names, again, they're going to tip us off that we're dealing with the north. And here's why. So go back to verse 1, right? "Give ear, O shepherd of Israel." You got a tangent here just with the use of the word shepherd, which was a way of referring to the king. David was the shepherd. But here, it's not David being shepherded. It's Joseph. "You who lead Joseph like a flock," which, fascinating enough, way back in Genesis chapter 48, verse 15, when Israel himself, Jacob, blesses Joseph and his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Oh, hint, hint. He says, "The God before whom my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, walked, the God who has been my shepherd all to this day." Now, he says more about the blessing, but here's the thing. So when the psalmist now is going to make this prayer on behalf of the people of Israel, with an emphasis on Joseph, right? He's going to refer to the blessing that was given to Joseph, which is that he would be shepherded by God. The same God who, verse 1 reminds us, is enthroned upon the cherubim. This is a prayer toward the very Ark of the Covenant, then, where God's presence has chosen to rest in the mountain city of Zion, Jerusalem, in Judah, down to the south. But now, we've mentioned Joseph, and now we mention both of his sons, but then you got someone shoved in the middle, before Ephraim and Benjamin and Manasseh. So Ephraim and Benjamin were sons of Joseph, remember this? Who each received a full portion in the land. They actually became tribes unto themselves. The way this works, and you still had 12 tribes, is the Levites were pulled out. They became kind of like a non-tribe that was still a tribe. So in a sense, you had 13 tribes, but not in terms of the apportionment of the land. When they went into the land, the Levites didn't get any land. So Ephraim and Manasseh become their own tribes, and then Benjamin's stuck in the middle. But do you remember that Benjamin, he has kind of a special connection with Joseph? Remember this? Benjamin is the only other son, besides Joseph, of Rachel. And so after Rachel's death, Jacob won't let him go down to Egypt, right? And Joseph isn't sure whether or not his brothers maybe murdered him too, that kind of thing. So now what you have is the entire bloodline of Rachel, who is, and here's what's going on, is effectively standing in as a representative of all the other brothers, just as Joseph did, just as Benjamin did, kind of as a sacrifice to Joseph, right? All the other brothers. So what you get here is northern Israel. Give ear, O shepherd of Israel, you who lead Joseph like a flock. The prayer is for the kingdom of the north. Now, whether this is before or after they're destroyed by Assyria, it's hard to say. I'm actually going to lean myself toward after, but I can understand why someone would say before. But the whole prayer here is to restore us. This is being prayed down at the Ark of the Covenant in Judah. So either way, it's praying for a restoration of the north to faith, of the kingdom to a unity, and of the throne of David over all of that to be the very thing which, well, saves the world, as it were. Restore us, O God. Let your face shine that we may be saved. You got a lot of other really beautiful language in here about the planting of a vine and how now the wall has been broken down around that vine and people just come through and ravage the vine, take whatever they want. You got this boar that comes tromping through the forest. It's just eating off the vine as ever, however it wants. That boar is probably a symbol of Assyria. Now, we can't be utterly certain about that. We don't know from extra biblical resources about that, but it sure seems to be the case. This boar is coming through. Then you got the wall being broken down with fire. That's what makes me think that northern Israel's already been taken away. But after the mention of this boar who's ravaging everything around, verse 14, later in the psalm, picks up and gets really earnest. Turn again, Elohim Sabaoth, right? God of war. Look down from heaven and see and regard this vine, the stock that you planted for the son whom you made strong for yourself. Now, there's a reference to Israel, the entire nation, as a single son. You might remember a prophecy that's told of Jesus. Out of Egypt I called my son. If you go and look up the original text for that prophecy, you find out it's speaking about the whole nation of Old Testament Israel, the 12 tribes of Egypt, including Joseph, right, and Manasseh and Ephraim, coming out of Egypt and going into the promised land. Here is a reference to that as well. Have regard for this son whom you made strong. They have burned it down. They have cut it down. Let your hand be upon the man of your right hand, the son of man, whom you have made strong for yourself. Verse 17, and here, this is so, the man of your right hand, Benjamin, my son, right? And then it uses this phrase, son of man, though, which later Hebrew commentators will say, this is the Christ. So that here we have a commingling of the nation of Israel and the one man, the Messiah. Well, the whole people and the king. And it's a prayer for the lifting up of that king, that he would come. Then, when he does, verse 18, we shall not turn back. Give us life, and we will call upon your name. Restore us, O Yahweh Elohim Sabaoth. Let your face shine, that we may be saved. All of that is about the coming of Jesus, whose face shone on the Mount of Transfiguration, who, as we've already said, made war against his enemies by dying on the cross, the victim who was the victor. He is the one who restores Israel, not a people of a bloodline, but an entire race, an entire humanity, broken and scattered by the fall, ravaged by the boar who is the devil. No more. no more. Yet we still pray this prayer, for we walk in this valley of shadow of death, waiting for the recompense, waiting for the God who made war against our enemy to come and to deliver to us the fruits of what he won, to clear the ground of the new age, to let us take a deep root, to rise from the dead, never to die again. Now, I took a lot of time to share that, and I even skipped over a couple of the cool parts there. Stuff I'll have to pick up next time, but we got to move forward here. The wisdom of Solomon, which joins us this morning, comes from Proverbs chapter 12, verse 24. The hand of the diligent will rule, while the slothful will be put to forced labor. So last Friday, we talked about how there's one emergent theme in the Proverbs, which is the tongue and the need to watch it carefully. That wisdom, in part, is not speaking quickly. Doesn't mean never speak. It means think about what you say before you say it. And this is doubly true when talking about, oh, you know, what God would say, right? I think God would say this. Whoa, slow down. What did God actually say? What has God said? Well, just as the tongue is a theme that emerges throughout the book, so also is duty and its evil counterpart, sloth. Sloth, slowness, laziness, tiredness. It's not just because you work so hard you're tired. It's more the, I will not lift my hand to help. And there's a number of things that take place over the course of this theme, so we're not going to get all of that right here in this one proverb. But what we see here is sort of the major idea that duty, vocation, following through on what is right, does eventually lead to good things. Whereas those who avoid what is right will eventually be led to bad things. Now, you can characterize this as justification by works if you want, and it is certainly true. That's kind of what it is teaching. But remember, Proverbs are not about, always, at least, eternal spirituality. Proverbs are about being general rules for the world in which we live. This is kind of the way things work out. And so, I mean, you could just say it this way. If you steal, good chance you go to jail. If you do work for somebody, good chance you get paid. Right? I mean, that's it. That's like the horizontal level of this psalm. Oh, God, that's obvious. Well, yeah, it is, and yet it's not to our flesh, right? Don't we always search for the easy way out? Don't we always look to not do our job? Isn't the American dream to be out of work? Right? Isn't that what retirement is? Is when I no longer do anything? Isn't that strange? Why do we hate what we do so much? Or have we lost sight on how what we do is really not about us, it's about others? And don't you think we might enjoy what we did more if we remembered why? If it wasn't for me? Now, there is also a truly spiritual edge deeper within this proverb. The hand of the diligent will rule. I mean, what did Jesus do? What did he do on the cross? What diligence he showed allowing his hands to be pierced with spikes, bearing the iniquity of the entire world. And what is the result of this? What is his vindication? He will rule. He does. He reigns, right? Whereas the slavery of our sin, the forced labor of our selfishness, continues to plague us outside of faith in him. But we who have faith in him, we are, this is the beauty of the gospel, how it is not the law, right? We are given the diligence, the duty fulfillment that Jesus did. His righteousness has been imputed to you. His duty fulfillment is yours now. Well, how do I make that happen? You don't make that happen. It's a promise. It's a gift. He just did it. You were trapped in the slavery of your own spiritual sloth, unwilling to lift your soul for any but yourself. He should have just left you there, but he didn't. He came down and he smothered you in his own duty, for you, toward you, on your behalf. So that now, as the letter to the Ephesians says, you already, Christian, are seated at the right hand of God the Father in the body of Jesus, ruling over all things. All that remains is for you to see it. Now, that's not going to happen until he comes back. Now, what we do while we wait, we believe it. Now, again, I've used a lot of time this morning. Short shrift to our confessions on Monday here. A little bit from the solid declaration of the formula of Concord. I'm not even going to tell you what any of that means. It's pretty cool, actually, what it means. But I just want to read to you paragraph 6 and 7 from Article 3 concerning the righteousness of faith before God, very much what we were just talking about. It says, the article on justification by faith, as the Apology says, is the most important of all Christian teachings, without which no poor conscience can have lasting comfort or recognize properly the riches of Christ's grace. As Dr. Luther wrote, quote, if this one teaching stands in its purity, then Christendom will also remain pure and good, undivided and unseparated. But where it does not remain pure, it is impossible to ward off any error or sectarian spirit. Regarding this article of faith, Paul specifically says, a little yeast leavens the whole batch of dough. And for this reason, he so earnestly and zealously advocates the use of these exclusive clauses in the article. That is, expressions such as, apart from the law, apart from works, on the basis of grace, which then exclude human works, so that Paul may demonstrate how highly necessary it is that in this article, alongside the pure teaching, one separate, exclude, and reject the antithesis, that is, all contrary teachings. If you ever do spend time reading the Book of Concord, I highly recommend it. Start with Luther's Catechism, the large catechism in the middle. Maybe start with the Creed. You can do the commandments. They will convict you, let me tell you. But, you know, it's good. It's good stuff. But if you want to just kind of get the juice, you know, go straight to the Creed in the large catechism. But if you spend much time reading the rest of the book, and again, I encourage you to do so bit by bit, you find that there's really only one thing they're super concerned with making sure we don't miss. And it's this thing that Luther just said. The article, the teaching that we are justified, so we were just talking about a moment ago, we are dutyified, we are diligencified, we are righteousified strictly by the work of Jesus outside of us on our behalf. And that we appropriate this, we receive this, we know about this, we see this, in quotes, only through faith in the promise. God says, you're righteous, and we believe it. And that itself is it. The cross has done it all. Our confessions are so concerned with making sure that that remains undefiled as a teaching, because that is the comfort, the confidence of Christianity, without which why would anyone ever convert? The whole point of Christianity is that you have a Savior. And that salvation, that's the good news. That's the gospel. That's the juice, which is going to bring other people to the church when they hear it. It's why you go too. It's why you're listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO, where we are the messenger of that good news. More of it coming up as we look more closely at Luke chapter 7 on the other side of this break, pulling out the sweet law, well, the sweet gospel and the good law for you. Stick around.